Today, we're going to talk about storytelling. I didn't know what to call this. I started out calling it feminist spirituality, but I was afraid that would keep some people away. But there's feminist elements in it. Also what seminarians might call narrative theology. But it's about empowering ourselves through story to share our own spirituality. Yesterday, I mentioned for resources Flora Wollner, who is the woman who does the prayer and healing books. I also mentioned Fred Buechner. I didn't put his name up. He's the Presbyterian minister who left the parish and writes novels and essays. And his work is in the bookstore. Real delightful if you haven't met him yet. He has a big following. He's the one who said that the churches are dying because the Holy Spirit has moved into the 12-step programs. And the other book that I want to push is Touching Our Strength by Carter Hayward. Carter Hayward is a lesbian Episcopalian priest, one of the first women to be ordained in the Episcopal Church. She has done, this is like her fourth or fifth book. Our Passion for Justice is another important book. This is her latest one, Touching Our Strength. And it's got the Christian intellectuals are all buzzing about this one, so you might want to join into the conversation. I thought I'd begin today just following the same pattern we did yesterday. I'll just talk a little bit at the beginning, and then we'll just share as a circle. And I wanted to talk about the name of God, which seemed to be kind of a basic place to start in our faith journey. You remember the story where Moses is out in the wilderness, and he's out there because he's broken the law. He's killed an Egyptian soldier. And he's hiding in the desert, and he's watching some sheep, and he has the revelation of the burning bush. And during that vision, the name of God is revealed to Moses, and it's this, and which technically is called the Tetragrammaton, which is Greek for four letters. And this is not a Hebrew word, it's like a non-word. And every, you know, when you read along in your Bible, maybe you've noticed that you'll, especially, particularly in the Old Testament, you're reading along and all of a sudden the word Lord appears, and all the letters are little capitals. Keep your eye open for that next time. Every time in our English Bible it says Lord in little capital letters, this is what's being translated. Lord being first used in the King James Version. So, in Hebrew tradition and Jewish tradition to this day, this is the sacred name of God. And not only is it not a real name, or a real word, but they're following the second commandment that we should not make images of God. And we usually think of idols as statues, but Judaism takes that so seriously that they also don't have verbal idols of God. And that's why in Judaism, you don't have any kind of religious statues. You also don't have natural images in Jewish art, like stained glass windows. And when you go to synagogue and they read the lectionary just like we do, only they only do the Old Testament, when the reader comes upon the name of God, it's not spoken. There's a pause, and everyone knows that what's being referred to. It's never spoken, and it appears in the page with this line through it, and there's two reasons for that. One is to remind the reader, him or herself, that this is not a real, this is not a word. The idea going all the way back to if we can name something, then we have power over it. We name it, we claim it, and this is unnameable. So occasionally, so that hymn fits perfectly with this lecture. I don't know what Larry is doing over there. Okay. So we, let's see, where should I go from here? Biblical scholarship over the last, say, 200 years has realized what this is about, and it's the conjugation of the Hebrew word verb to be. And we'll get back to that in a minute, but as the centuries and centuries passed, and no one spoke this word, even by the time of Jesus, what that was about got to be forgotten, and it was just a sacred name. But the problems come then when Christianity emerges and missionaries go out into the Roman Empire, and they have to translate this concept into Greek. And this is a very foreign concept to the rest of the world, you know, and so we start getting in Paul's writings more and more of a Zeus-like kind of God. I mean, Paul doesn't have to do that, it's just he's talking about God, and the Greeks are like thinking in terms of this, so we get this male Zeus-like God who lives on top of Mount Olympus and has messengers who go down to humanity, and ideas about, you know, when the Jews are talking about the inspired word of God, the Greeks are hearing those same words in the sense of a Zeus-like God who's like whispering dictation. And we go into Roman culture and we get Deus, which is very similar, and Roman culture is very much involved with law, and their contribution to Western civilization is legalism and a justice system, and we inherit that all these centuries later because when we build court buildings, they look like Roman institutions. We still have pillars and all of that stuff. And then as centuries pass, we get missionaries going after the fall of Rome into Northern Europe, and we get German images of God, which is the thunder god and the lightning god, these natural forces. And we end up with our English word. And all this doesn't have very much to do with this original revelation. Luther comes across this word, he being the first person to translate it, the Bible, into common languages. He comes across these four letters, and they don't make any sense. He's literally a seminary professor who teaches Bible in Germany at the time. So he's translating it into German, and very arbitrarily he chooses some vowels to stick in between these letters so that it becomes pronounceable. And of course, in German, our Y sound is a J, as in Yashir Yibetcha. And in German, W's are pronounced as V's. And that's how we come up with Jehovah, was Luther's very arbitrary making this a pronounceable sound. So that's how we got Jehovah, which becomes a name like Sally or Frank, for the name of God. But all the way back, what this is coming for is not really an abbreviation, but a reminder of the conjugation of the verb to be. So you get in Hebrew, and more in our churches we're starting to say Yahweh, and I think that's I think that's helpful for us in the Western Christian tradition to get away from Sally Frank Jehovah images, but we need to also keep in mind that it's extremely disrespectful to Jewish tradition to be pronouncing the name of God. So what Yahweh is in Hebrew is was, is, will be. That's who we're worshiping. And this line is here not only to remind the reader that this isn't a real world word, but also to remind us that the future is part of God also, and only God knows that. We can't see that. So this, all this story allows Paul Tillich, who's an important theologian, to define God as being itself. And Tillich, who was a German Christian intellectual who escaped Nazi Germany and moved to the United States and taught in the 50s at Union Seminary in New York, and developed a whole system of thinking called systematic theology. His book is probably the most influential theologian of the 20th century, and everything that's happened since then has been very much influenced, theologically speaking, has been influenced by his word studies and sort of breaking open traditional language. But the interesting thing for me then is to reflect on what it is for us to say that we're created in Yahweh's image. And we hear a lot about, which we'll talk about together in a few minutes, we hear a lot about liberation theology and feminist theology, but in terms of the, you know, kind of the straight male intellectual head trips that are going on still in seminary, they still go on, we just don't talk about them very much. But the big thing going these days is called process theology. And kind of the leader, the first person who start talking about this new thing called process theology is a British man named Alfred Lord Whitehead. He was an aristocrat. And he was a scientist who got tired of being a scientist and became a theologian. And he started taking his insights from science and applying them into how we talk about God. And his work then opened up this whole area that we call process theology. And it's really pretty simple, at least as I understand it, and that's because I don't understand science. But I can, Joe's here, he can tell us about it. But how it's helpful to me is that the way we used to talk about theology before the 20th century fit really well with what we called Newtonian physics. Newton is the guy who sat under the apple tree and the apple fell on his head, and he said, oh, the universe is ruled by laws that are unchanging. And that's sort of how we thought about God and human nature, and it's all unchanging. How amazing that this ancient revelation of God's name is about, that God is not a noun, God is a verb. And that goes into is compatible with our physics today. I mean, we think of this table as being a solid object that's kind of unchanging, and I can trust in its solidity. But on the other hand, we know that this table is not really a noun at all. This table is, you know, billions and billions and billions of little atoms that are like dancing all around. And this is a verb, this is in process. And everything around us, all of our life is a process, is in movement, is in action. And that gives us a whole lot of freedom to be in God's image in process. You know, we don't need to, there's not like these moral laws and rules that we need to like cram ourselves into to try to fit, and then we arrive and then we never change after that, but rather, like God, we are in process, and it's okay to be in process, and life is about changing and movement, and maybe storytelling is a better way of getting at that reality than scientific or philosophical kinds of, is that right brain?
No,
left brain. I'm so much of a right brain that I can't even understand left brain. But maybe storytelling is a more realistic way of getting at the reality of God and our relationship with God and with each other than like philosophical categories. And finally, that hooks into what's happening in feminist theology, which is, among other things, a real basic groundwork kind of piece of feminism in general and feminist theology in particular is telling our stories to each other, and that we start there, and then if we feel like it, maybe we can make some generalizing kind of statements, but we don't start with generalized philosophical or theological statements and then try to fit them, but rather we talk about our real life and our real experience, and that's part of what Touching Our Strength is about, that it's embodied and it's interpersonal, and then authority becomes not something that straight white men in Germany who are dead now impose on our lives, but rather authority is our relationship with each other and how the spirit is revealed in relationship. So she goes as far as to say, Carter Hayward goes as far as to say, for example, in her interpretation of in the beginning, John writes, in the beginning was the Logos, which Luther translated as word, in the beginning was the word, and that has a lot to do with his personal location, because what had just been invented? The printing press. And it's just like it had as much impact as the computer has on our generation. All of reality was changing in Europe. Eric Erickson, the great psychologist who does historical studies of people who interest him, wrote a biography of Luther, and he picked Luther as being one of the most fascinating people in history because he's like this one-person bridge between the medieval age and the modern age. And just like we are going through a bridge now from the modern age to the new age or the postmodern age or whatever you want to call it, where we're going, we can't see that real clearly. But part of that change from medievalism to modernism is technologically based. The inventing of the printing press allowed mass publication for the first time. It allowed the Reformation to happen because people were like really getting into pamphlets and passing them around. And people got into literacy for the first time, and ideas of like personal conscience and making up your own decision, making up your own mind. And those were all really important things. Luther was so taken up by the power of the word that he once wrote he was concerned for the eternal salvation of deaf people because they couldn't hear sermons. And on the one hand, that's like superstitious medieval stuff. But on the other hand, it shows again that bridge into the modern age, because we, in the modern age, we think of communication as being the means of grace, that somehow it's the communicating process. So, he translated this as word, and that was a very exciting, vital kind of concept in the 1500s. But this word is also, in Greek, logos is the root of logic, of course, in our language, and it has more to do with purpose. You know, that kind of purpose in the sense of cause and effect. So we might, and think of what happens when you take John, and who was writing in Greek, and you say, in the beginning was the purpose, and the purpose was with God, and the purpose became flesh and dwelt among us, full of truth and grace. You get, it starts having all sorts of, at least I get real fascinated, and I like that, thinking of Jesus as the incarnation of the purpose, and how that purpose is revealed to me through that. I didn't intend to go in that direction. It was fun, but now I don't know where I'm going next. I was in the middle of feminism. Okay, so maybe we can reveal that. So in the same way that the scripture itself is a series of stories. It's not till the very end of scripture, when we get Paul's letters, that we start like intellectualizing about, we're reflecting into, you know, really theologizing, but the whole salvation history is a series of stories that were remembered by the people. And we theologians call it indwelling. That's where I was going with John. The Logos becomes flesh and dwells among us. And we dwell in the stories of our faith, and then the stories give us meaning. If we commit ourselves to them, to carrying on the story, then the meaning of the story can also become our meaning. So I see that as a real natural nexus between feminist values and pretty basic biblical values. Sometimes when I'm speaking to feminists, I think I'm the only one who sees that, but I think there's some hope in bridge building there. Any questions or responses, ideas that pop into your minds with all this?
The process theology sounds like that button that people sometimes wear that says, please be patient, God isn't finished with me yet.
Yeah.
Is that their little slogan sort of?
They're a little highbrow to use that, but I think that's the concept.
It popped into my head. Mm-hmm.
In the gay community, we often say, my karma ran over my dogma. That's sort of the process. Any more or other responses? Does this kind of make sense? And we're more than that, even feel comfortable?
Isn't some of the problem that some people have with process theology is that sometimes the implication is that God is in process, and we're used to defining God as the know-all and be-all and end-all and the omnipotent.
Yeah, the idea that, yes.
I mean, it leaves God a little more open-ended.
And that's, if you really start following, you know, through on those lines of thinking, it can get real challenging, I think. And I'm thinking not so much intellectually as emotionally, because it's really redefining some of those categories. But when you read the Old Testament, there's a little, you know, big parts of the Old Testament that we never read because in our churches, because they're like really violent and stuff. But there's often times when the children of Israel have gone through some horrible fate that is some kind of punishment for unfaithfulness, and then it'll say that God repents. And we don't have any, you know, that's the God repenting and God changing God's mind and doing something different is not the category we think of, but it's very biblical. I think when I talk with groups about inclusive language, and they're really, like, people get really conflicted over that, I mean, I think a real basic part of our faith is going back to that second commandment that, you know, if you're so stuck in a particular name for God, like Father, instead of being open to playing with that, you're breaking the second commandment. And you're not being true to God's name as it has been revealed to us, which is, what does it say in the footnote when you read it? When you see this, you see the Lord, and there's a little note at the bottom of your RSV in the Moses story, and it's, I am what I am becoming. So we often abbreviate that to this. And, I mean, sometimes, even in normal church settings, we hear God referred to as the great I am.
Yeah, I've always been real conflicted over Old and New Testament theology and how it can be describing the same God. And what you're saying is God makes mistakes too, and that's very biblical, is one of the big, appear to be a real big mistake that God was so violent and so vindictive and so angry, and then with the coming of Christ really changed
her tune.
is that an explanation I think of the New Testament as being the good news. Yeah, good news. God's changed his mind after all. You know, we have some hope for ourselves.
Well, I guess the feelings that come up in me as you're asking that are kind of yes and no. Like, I feel, I don't know, but I don't want to get too anthropomorphic, like saying God makes mistakes feels a little anthropomorphic. Saying that God is in process or God changes seems like that God evolves. I mean, the Noah and the flood story is God changing God's mind. I mean, God gets angry and destroys the earth and then repents of that, and the rainbow is the promise that God will never do that again. But also there's the process of how the people of God perceive what's going on, and I think that's certainly what we see reflected in Scripture. And it's not just old and new, but, I mean, the Old Testament covers 3,000 years. Bible is simply the Greek word for library, biblos, like a bibliography, a list of books at the end of your term paper. And there's all sorts of different perceptions of God in between. There's the Exodus kinds of stories, and then there's that legalistic stuff that was Leviticus and Deuteronomy that's developed during the exile, when they're afraid of losing their identity in a strange land, and then there's the prophets. So there's a real developing understanding of who God is and what it is to be in relationship with God.
Mm-hmm. I think, in part, the way that I see the Bible is a reflection of our understanding of the process more than the process itself, because it's much bigger than we are. It is unknowable. And it seems as if it's trying to find definition in something that there is no definition of. And how can we comprehend something that we can't even acknowledge and what we're getting are bits and pieces, and it is in process. There is no end point, and so to say that it was a mistake or not a mistake, we're still in the process of it. So it's like, you know, formulating your conclusion before the experiment is even done with. We're still in that flow, so we don't know what it is. And a lot of what thought becomes is then to try and have it make sense to us, and that's what has happened from the very beginning of history. And I think in looking at the Bible, and I am not a Bible scholar, I was raised a Catholic, we didn't even have a Bible, but looking at the stories, and the stories reflect the pulse and the feel and the process of the people during that time, and I think it's more their understanding than the actuality of the process itself, and that's the only way that we know. I mean, the only way that I really know God is through people, through the manifestations of God that I have around me. And I don't even know if I love God. I mean, if I think, okay, I love God, I don't know that. I love people, I love plants, I love dirt, I love the creation of this unknowable essence, but I can't comprehend God. I mean, realistically, unless I picture my grandpa or something, then I think, or my grandma, or my cat, I don't know. You know, I think, oh, okay, I love God. But it's such a vast thing, and it's almost arrogant to think that we can even create something to represent it in play.
Well, and I think part of what makes me experience, for example, the revelation of to Moses and the Ten Commandments as being indeed a revelation is that those prehistoric tribal people, it's a miracle to me that those prehistoric tribal people came up with, it's like, I don't see how they could come up with on their own, this incredibly sophisticated insight about the name of God and this basic tenet of the tradition that you don't make images of God. You don't make images of God because that boxes it in. you don't make representations of what that is. And we're all on different journeys. And I hear what you're saying, and also I feel like I do have a love relationship with God, and that there's, but that probably has a lot to do with my cultural upbringing and things. But I was just reading a couple days ago that the notion that tradition the importance of tradition is that it breaks up the elitism of the present. that not only us in this circle get to talk about God, but those who have gone before us and can't be in our circle because they're doing something else, are present through tradition, and that we covenant to take them seriously too, and they're, and in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the major way we receive their presence is through Scripture. I used to teach English, high school English, and I had this kid once who like refused to read books, which was a major problem for me in my school. And he thought he was real sophisticated and said that he didn't, he felt he only found valid communication, I don't know what words he used, it was years ago, but he only found valid communication in talking to other people. And I had to point out to him that books are written by other people, and that's how, you know, we get them, and that we are communicating with other people over time. He hadn't thought of it that way.
One little response to the sense of the Old Testament, New Testament. I kind of sense that God in the Old Testament is exactly the same as the God of the New Testament. The theology of the covenant, the Exodus and salvation theology is all built in. And the absolute salvation, you know, right from the beginning. It's not Jesus being new. He just incarnated that which God is all the way through. And so you can read the Old Testament, and that's where my Jewish friends, you know, have just as much salvation, right to salvation as I do, because they're the God of the Old Covenant, or the God of the Covenant, period. And that's really opened up the Old Testament in a very enlightening book. There's many more facets even in the New Testament of the idea of story of people. I don't want the Old Testament to be a bad rap.
Yeah, and it's always important to lift up that perspective. Because of how most of us are brought up, it's real easy to slip back into talking about it that way without really catching ourselves. Because I've come to a place where I think that through Christ, we Gentiles get to join the Jews in the covenant. that was the ministry. Because certainly there's grace in the Old Testament. But also in the process, to use that word again, in the process, I think as we move into the New Testament era, and certainly through the ministry of Jesus, who we also forget is Jewish, in the process, we do get an increasingly fuller revelation of who Yahweh is in our relationship with her. Does this kind of feel liberating to people, or it does to me? I like being in process, as opposed to having to arrive somewhere and stay there. Well,
Dan?
Yes.
I'm trying to reconstruct what, I guess I'll say felt, feels sometimes threatening about it. And I don't think, I mean, that the boundary, the way it's been talked about it is all pretty hard to sounds pretty good, but I'm also trying to think about where in my own history pieces of this, not as you've talked about them today, but have made me uncomfortable. And I think there are places, I'm not sure I have particular ones right now. I guess maybe you've talked in the past week with some things about authority. I think that there are some places in this that have implications for authority that if we focused on them straight ahead rather than indirectly would probably make us first, either might make us feel liberated or might make us feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. Authority is one of those kind of central issues in life, and that we struggle with, and that religious tradition, whatever, you know, not only different denominations in Christianity, but all religion is one of the basic questions in life is authority. So it's a central religious question, and we come up with religious traditions come up with different understandings of authority, but part of the value, but also part of the bane of that is that it's a kind of question we don't like to grapple with. So it's nice to have a good, solid, secure definition of
authority that we don't have to worry about. Because it kind of, it's, using another Paul Tillich phrase, it shakes the foundations of our whole lives if we start looking at authority in different ways.
I guess what I was really getting at was I wonder what makes people, what is it about, say, the feminist thing that makes people uncomfortable, even? We've been talking fairly abstractly, and we're saying that this feels comfortable, but I was wondering where it might also feel uncomfortable.
Well, it makes sense to me, Dan, and I like it, except that nothing in my life has prepared me for this. When I get right down to it, the educational system I've been through, the mainline church experience I've had has left me thinking that I ought to get finished somewhere and then be able to go on and live. And to know now at my age that I'm just going to go on and on and on. The process is a continuing thing. Is a tremendously exciting and at the same time a very, very discouraging thought. I don't know if anyone else relates to this or not, but I mean, it's like, well, what have I done for 56 years? Does any of that count? And what is my own voice? And how can I mean, you've written up your personal location, my own voice and narrative and you know, I live in my right brain, and I come here to a very left brain place, and I'm afraid to talk. So I move. I don't know. That's just one of the things that I bump into.
Yes, except isn't there some kind of paradox in what you just said about, you know, nothing prepares you in terms of all of the, like, school and church and stuff, except that haven't your 56 years shown you that it is more of a process?
Of course, but there's that old pattern that still says, hey,
so we get, they call it, it's a phrase I love, cognitive dissonance, like the experience and the head trip don't fit anymore together in your life.
Right.
That's when your karma runs over your dad.
Yeah, right.
And I think how this has become such an important part of feminism is that we got to a point in history where large numbers of women were saying to male theologians, excuse me, but you can't define my reality anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm having a different experience than you, and I would like to speak for myself. And so are people of color, and so are gay and lesbian people, and I always feel sorry for, and I see it even here now these days at Holden, when we bring some of these things up, that straight white men can get like defensive and scared and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I like to always make sure to say that it's not that they're wrong or bad, it's that the rest of us just want to join in the conversation and say, when you're talking about your straight white male experience, please claim it as that, and then let the rest of us claim our own experience in our own ways, and then we can all talk about it and in a circle and maybe end up with some shared perceptions about what reality is really like. And that's a process, as opposed to doctrine.
Right.
Which we have, Dan hasn't spoken yet.
It seems like we're kind of uncomfortable living with the idea of process, and I think it reflects the fact that we still pretty much live with a Platonic way of thinking, rights or wrongs, blacks or whites, us or them. It's really hard for us to incorporate things in process or in a flow. It either has to be this or that. It can't just be, we can't deal with things in the flow very well.
Yes, and it's really Greek, Platonic is good, and it's unbiblical. So there. It's like I used in another setting somewhere last week. Christianity has gotten into this bizarre place where we think that we're saved by believing the story instead of believing in what it means. So it's like we read the story of Daniel and the lion's den, and we have arguments over whether that's literally true or not. Meanwhile, missing the point of the story, which is we know how the story about Daniel and the lion's den ends, but Daniel didn't. You know, when he goes into the lion's den, he's having a faith experience. Living through that, and then he lives to tell the story. Mm-hmm. And the point of the story is to teach us how to live in faith in an open-ended reality, you know, instead of like I have this image of, they were like those little bloodsucker things on the fish tank, you know, I mean, it's like we suck onto those stories, and then we, mm-hmm. and that's our security, and we argue over the stories instead of living out the faith mm-hmm. journey that Daniel's been on, or Luther, or whatever. You know, it's a real interesting, I think that's the difference between Luther and Melanchthon, who comes in the next generation, that kind of establishes the Reformation, and it stops being a movement and becomes a doctrine. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Process is also the only way, I think, towards self-empowerment, because it's very interactive and we are involved in the process. We are part of the dance and we have choices and there are options available to us. And I think oftentimes that can be very threatening, especially when you're clinging to something that's static and unmovable. It's a safe place. And you give up a lot of your power in doing that, and staying sort of stuck in one place. But if you're continuing to evolve, then of course you're making choices along the way. But it's also a very hopeful place to be, because you're not done yet. Nobody's done yet. And it seems like through our stories, that's how we can empower one another to continually share them, to share the parts of our journey. And then we all come together no matter, you know, what our individual places may be. It's dynamic.
So, for example, there's the interactive stories, which I'd like to move to now and actually do some of this with each other. But as transitionally speaking, one of the definitions of preaching is that is the responsibility of the preacher is to speak in continuity with the word. In other words, what's happening, the stories of the Bible, there's a continuity with the stories. I mean, an effective preacher is a storyteller, you know, who can get the congregation indwelling in a story and then comes out on the another side and hopefully has some spiritual insight. But we don't need to depend only on a preacher to do that. We can do that with each other by sharing our stories. And what I thought we'd do as a little exercise that's kind of low vulnerability but might be interesting, we'll see, is to just take a couple moments of silence and reflect on what was the last event before you got here? What were you doing before when you said, oh, it's time to leave? And just reflect on that and reflect on the walk from that place to this one. And think of that as a story, and then I don't know, what change in something that mundane, what change or insight came even in that little walk? So if you want to get comfortable in your chair.
close your eyes and focus inward. And just do it at a leisurely pace. We'll have a couple minutes. Just go back to where you were sitting before you were sitting here. Remember that conversation or whatever. Retravel your life. Here in the circle. Just do some sharing.
Mm-hmm. And several of the people in this group know I was holding the baby.
A little louder.
I was holding the baby the last hour. Yeah. I was doing a little babysitting, but the baby fell asleep. And I realized it was the first time in 10 days I have sat still for 1 hour without deliberately focusing on ideas or the gardening or sleeping. And sometimes it seems to me I get this, I always forget if it's right or left brain either, but I'm all one, and now and then I have to get into that. Just sit and reminds me of the saying, what is life? If full of care, we have no time to stand and stare. Or sit and stare, or just, you know, you let go. I find myself much too caught up in things and stuff.
Kind of be still and know that I am God.
And Copper Falls, and I had to work very hard at clearing my mind of all of the stuff that's been poured on me in the last week. I found it really difficult to clear my mind to something different. And then just immediately before coming in here, I was debating whether to go to the session next door or here, and then I recalled that I wasn't here yesterday. Has to do with wholeness, and something made a connection, and I just walked in here. I'm very glad that I did. And now I have some word process.
I was sitting on the log with my very tired 8-year-old daughter, wanting to come to this class. She also didn't want to be alone or want to play with me, but and it flashed on me as we were walking over, and she was being upset that I have the choices and she doesn't. I'm trying to balance that out.
That's a great example of how we are theologizing all of the time in our lives. I mean, we're always reflecting on what we're doing, and part of that is making ethical choices. Part of that is understanding our relationships with ourselves and others. And we're always processing this all the time. We don't need, it's not only experts who theologize. tell us what to do.
Well, I've been in the laundry since 6 this, about 10 after 6 this morning, and I was tired. And I had decided a couple choices I could, there was more than that, but two I thought of, I could go on and lie down for a while or come here. And I decided that I probably would feel more revitalized if I came here instead of lying down, and I do feel better already.
I was aware of how much I depend on ritual to make my life day to day as productive as I can. I'm real task oriented. And Holden has been real jarring to me in that I can't establish a routine no matter how hard I try, because if I want to set a certain hour for a shower, for instance, then there's a workshop or something that I want to do. So it's real jarring and it's wearing, it's tiring. I found myself last night at 9 o'clock just exhausted. So I got 10 hours sleep last night. That's the first time in 2 weeks I've gotten more than 6, I think. So routine is real important, and there is a routine. And but that's I value that because routine also is very limiting. Just like we're talking about, if God is a block of stone and we can attach to him, that's real comfortable. But it's also not very growing. So I find that that's one of the ways that I really grow a lot here. I think is I can't. You know, I can't just get into a routine, into a rut, automatic. I haven't been on automatic pilot since I came here. But that doesn't have a whole lot to do with where I was sitting before I came here.
I've kind of gotten the opposite experience. Right before I came here, I was asleep. I had fallen asleep. But before that, I had been reading. I'd brought a lot of reading in my journal. And as I was coming down, I was actually sort of the opposite, sort of thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing the sessions, that I happen to be a person where sort of going to sessions and talking about things and so on is a kind of an old habit and an old pattern for me. And maybe instead I ought to just sort of be quiet a little bit more and not be as engaged with some of this. There's sort of such a richness here that I get drawn into things. Last week there was somebody here who was doing 12-step things, and I proposed to him we needed a program for people who were addicted to going to sessions. So I thought maybe that was what I needed. So I sort of was walking down, my journey was, I had, even as I re-envisioned it was not clear to me whether I should have made the journey or not, wonderful as it was, whether I should have sort of stayed with someone quiet.
You both talked about, in different ways, about this task-oriented thing, and that also for me is... intellectualizing is one of my favorite things to do, and I have to remember that it's a hobby and not God. And the part of the change into the from dogmatic theology to process theology is this emotional shift from even our relationship with God is a task-oriented activity into, we don't have an agenda here, and there's not a goal to this conversation other than we trust in the process that as we bounce off each other, revelation happens outside of our control, and
that that's good. And and I think it brings us back again to that, what we're supposed to be engaged in is a relationship with God, not a puzzle solving, we're not here to define God, we're here to be in a relationship with God. And that's like all our other relationships. They grow and they change, and the more we commit ourselves to the relationship, the more we dwell in the relationship, the more we get out of it. And that's a real, and I think as Western folks, it's good to be reminded every once in a while that we're called into relationship, not to define God. Even though, for many of us, myself included, that defining part can be one of the most fun parts, but there's more to life than that.
I just came from working in the store and running the store, and all day long you work with numbers and sales and what's moving and what isn't moving, and it's really clinical and detail work. And I find it really relaxing just to come to a session, and it's a lot more poetic when you deal with things that don't have answers, and we don't come to any conclusions, really, anything concrete. I find real beauty in that open-endedness.
I had gone on a walk for an hour and a half with a 2.5-year-old, 4-year-old, and usually my idea of walks is going to the lake. That's the goal, to come back. It's real, very male-oriented, what I do every day of my life. And at this walk, there was no goal. We just went, and it was very enjoyable to kind of experience that walk as a child, and it kind of touched on what you were talking about last night, getting in touch with that inner child in yourself, and which kind of made me feel very vulnerable. So actually just walking down here was kind of threatening to touch on that and not have things be black and white and gold and have the blinders on.